messieurs, nous allons...
Mesdames, messieurs, voilà. Nous allons reprendre nos travaux. En écoutant monsieur Charles Mencken, qui est donc professeur à l'Université du Maryland. Excusez-moi. Et qui, ce matin, donc, comme je l'annonçais tout à l'heure, va nous parler de l'étude de la logique et de ses conséquences, son impact culturel dans le monde hébraïque, chez les Juifs du Midi de la France, donc 12e, 14e siècle. Et il a sous-titré cette contribution, A Tribute to Mauro Zonta, qui est l'un des grands savants disparus, effectivement, ces derniers mois. Et on aurait pu, d'une certaine façon, mais Julie l'a fait déjà hier, considérer que ce que nous avions à dire sur Byzance et l'islam, ce qui a précédé, était tribute to Marc Geoffroy. Mais alors je le dis, mais je donne tout de suite la parole à Monsieur Mencken, qui, d'après son résumé, enfin son abstract, comme on dit, va évoquer Lunel. Et Lunel, c'est une ville qui est particulièrement chère aux médiévistes, d'une part pour les raisons qu'il va dire, à savoir c'est le lieu des Thibonides, des grands traducteurs de Maïmonide. Mais c'est aussi, en sa bibliothèque municipale, le dépositaire, cette ville est la dépositaire de l'unique manuscrit connu de la Logica Nostrorum Petitioni Sociorum d'Abélard. Voilà. Je donne la parole en vous remerciant.
Merci.
La communication se fera en anglais.
Je vais parler en anglais. Pardonnez-moi. I'd like to thank the organizers, especially Julie and Alain, for this wonderful opportunity to speak on somewhat unknown part of the history of logic, and that is the history of Hebrew logic. And today I will speak focus on the history of Hebrew logic in the Jewish communities in the Midi, in the south of France. So beginning in the middle of the 12th century and lasting until the end of the 16th century, there was a flowering of scientific learning among the Jewish communities in the Midi, in what is called provincia in contemporary Hebrew literature, which includes not only Provence, but basically the entire southern part of today's France, westward till Spain. Right. This learning was based almost entirely on Hebrew translations of Arabic and Latin texts. Prior to the mid-12th century, the Midi was bereft of scholars of scientific studies. By the middle of the 13th century, philosophy and science had firmly taken root. A half century later, Jediah of Béziers would write, "There were Joshua the son of Nun to visit Provence and prohibit the study of philosophy, the sages of Provence would pay no attention to him." What is particularly interesting about this activity was that it existed without any institutional or communal support in the Jewish communities of the Midi. What we know of Jewish sages of logic is what is reported in their names in the works preserved. And these works are the data from which we reconstruct our intellectual history. As for social history, we have no registration figures at faculties of arts, or inventories of libraries, because these were not relevant for the Jews. We have no evidence from this period that Jewish houses of study formally included secular subjects. Rather, disciples studied privately with tutors or masters, often their relatives, and wealthy Jews served occasionally as patrons, and also wealthy non-Jews for that matter. That's another story. Itinerant scholars went searching for manuscripts and patrons and both. What then accounted for this flowering? According to the standard historiography, there was a confluence of four factors. First, the migration to Provence of Jewish scholars from Al-Andalus after the Almohad conquest in the middle of the 12th century. Second, the eagerness of Provençal Jewish scholars to receive Andalusian Arabic culture. Third, the proximity and easy flow of Jews between the Jewish communities in Provence and northern Spain, which had been reconquered by the Christians. And fourth, the arrival in the late 12th and early 13th century of the works of Moses Maimonides, works that fueled the translation movement from Arabic to Hebrew that began first with works of Jewish ethics and theology, then Hebrew grammars, then scientific encyclopedias and elementary treatises, and finally the works of Aristotle according to Averroes, paraphrases and long commentaries supplemented by some Latin material, mostly medical textbooks employed by Jewish physicians. The paraphrases and commentaries of Averroes spawned Jewish commentators, Jewish commentaries, and independent treatises in the late 13th and 14th centuries. Perhaps yet another factor was the Arabic to Latin translation movement in which some Jews played a part. Before we focus on the place of Hebrew logic in this cultural flowering, we should consider briefly the status of logic in Jewish intellectual life before the era of the Hebrew translations. With few exceptions, Jews in the Arabic literate world wrote little in the way of logic and translated nothing into Hebrew. What they knew of logic was based on Arabic texts. One of the earliest references in Hebrew to the science of logic is found in a work written in 1161 by the Spanish Jewish grammarian and scriptural exegete Abraham ibn Ezra, known as The Foundation of All and the Secret of the Torah. In this work, Abraham ibn Ezra claims that the science of logic is one of the things that a Jewish intellectual must know, and he praises logic for its doctrine of the five utterances, especially the hierarchies of universal and particular, which enable the proper categorization and enumeration of the biblical commandments. That same year, 1161, Judah ibn Tibonid, a Jewish intellectual who migrated from Al-Andalus to Lunel, embarked on a series of translations of Jewish pietistic and philosophical works at the behest of Jacob ben Meshulam of Lunel. These works were written in Judeo-Arabic for cultural Jews with background in philosophy, poetry, and belles lettres. The very first work translated by Judah is the philosophically challenging first chapter of Bachi ibn Pakuda's pietistic book of virtue, The Duties of the Heart. That may have fueled the need for ancillary works. The next work Judah translated into Hebrew in Lunel in 1165 was Judah Halevi's dialogue, The Kuzari. Although the work generally disparages the pretension of philosophy to provide the road to human happiness, it often engages with philosophical literature and claims, again requiring knowledge in philosophy. Halevi describes the art of logic in the context of a long passage on the faculties of the soul. The second, and that's the one that's on the PowerPoint. The secondary intelligibles apprehended through rational acquisition are those that are derived by means of concludent reasoning and demonstrative derivation, that is, through the conceptual of rational truths, such as genera, species, specific differences and their properties, the separate expressions, and those arranged in various sorts of combinations, the true and false composite syllogisms, and the two premises that yield necessary demonstrative conclusions, or dialectical, rhetorical, or sophistical, or poetical. A 15th century Italian Jewish commentator noted that in this passage, Halevi summarizes the contents of the nine books of the Organon, as expanded in the late Hellenistic and Arabic periods. We may conjecture that a teacher of the Kuzari to the Jews of Provence in the second half of the 12th century would have to make this connection orally, since no description of the Organon had appeared in Hebrew at this time, as far as we know, much less actual translations of any logical writings. Now, this last point may need to be modified if Zonta's conjecture that some of Al-Farabi's logical writings were translated into Hebrew anonymously as early as the second half of the 12th century is correct. Dating the Al-Farabi Hebrew logic translations is very difficult, and our research group next year on the impact of Aristotelian logic on medieval Jewish cultures, we'll be looking at them carefully for linguistic clues. Most of the Al-Farabi translations into Hebrew are anonymous, and there are at least two, and in one case, six versions in the manuscripts for each of the short treatises and introductory essays. While some of the Al-Farabi translation may have taken place in Provence towards the end of the 12th century, I think it is more likely to view them as a 13th century phenomenon. Aside from Al-Farabi's popularity as a logician in Al-Andalus, his reputation in Provence got a boost after he was praised by Maimonides in an epistle that Maimonides wrote to Samuel ibn Tibbon, which advised him not to busy himself with any other books of logic except those composed by Al-Farabi. That letter is dated shortly before Samuel, the son of Judah ibn Tibbon, completed the first version of his translation of the Guide of the Perplexed in 1204. His revised translation in 1213 is of particular interest to us here because Samuel appended to it a philosophical glossary called Explanation of the Strange or Foreign Words in the Master's Treatise, that is, the Guide of the Perplexed, in which Ibn Tibbon included some passages from Al-Farabi's short treatise on the isagoge and the categories, presumably in his own translation. Samuel Ibn Tibbon also included an Al-Farabian-inspired summary of logic and a discourse on the syllogism in his mature work, Commentary on Ecclesiastes, one of the first philosophical exegeses of scripture in Provence, written probably after 1213. Two other 13th century introductory works, the short treatise on the art of logic attributed to Maimonides, which was translated first in Provence in 1255 by Samuel's son Moses, and the section on logic in the beginning of wisdom by Shem Tov ben Joseph Falakera around the same time, are Farabian in context. The Farabian logical corpus represents the first of two pillars of the study of logic among the Jews of the Midi. The second is Averroes paraphrases or middle commentaries of the books of the Organon. Already in Samuel Ibn Tibbon's philosophical glossary of 1213, there are signs of Averroes' paraphrases and epitome. But it is not until 1232 that the first five books of the middle commentary on the Organon were translated by Jacob Anatoly, Samuel's son-in-law and brother-in-law, at the behest of Jewish scholars in Narbonne and Béziers. Anatoly intended to complete his translation of the remaining four books of the expanded Organon, but apparently he never did. The paraphrases of the Topics and Sophistics were completed in 1313 by Colonimus ben Colonimus in Al, and the Rhetoric and Poetics in 1337 by Todrus Todrusi in Trinquetai near Al. These paraphrases of Averroes became the canonical texts of logic for Jews in the next several centuries, starting in southern France, Italy, Spain, and Byzantium. For southern France, the paraphrases stood in for the original text of Aristotle, which were never translated into Hebrew. I always add, apologetically, until the present day. Except for now, I think the Poetics has been translated into modern Hebrew. Averroes' paraphrases on the books of the Organon were translated from Hebrew into Latin in the 16th century and published in the Junta edition of the works of Aristotle, the front cover of which, one volume of which we saw yesterday. To round out this picture of the fundamental texts of logic studied by the Jews of Provence, I should mention Averroes' Epitome of Logic, translated in 1288 by Jacob ben Machir, Samuel ibn Tibbon's nephew in Montpellier, and an anonymous translation of Ghazali's Opinions of the Philosophers several years later, one of three translations into Hebrew. Both were the subject of later commentaries in Provence, the first in the mid-15th century by Mordechai ben Natan of Avignon, the second in the mid-14th century by Moses ben Joshua of Narbonne. Now, with the exception of Averroes' paraphrases, the works of logic I have mentioned so far are relatively elementary. They avoid or merely summarize some of the more difficult doctrines in Aristotle's logic, such as the theory of the modal syllogism. Of course, the more elementary they were, the more popular. On the whole, most of the logic texts in Hebrew were elementary, and instruction was presumably at a rather elementary level before the student went on to other works. The motivations given for the study of logic were varied. Maimonides had emphasized the importance of logic for understanding physics and metaphysics, which he identified with the esoteric wisdom of the Jews that had been lost in their wanderings. He also thought it important to know the epistemic status of arguments of religiously problematic doctrines held by the philosophers, for example, the eternity of the world, and that required knowledge of logic. But other reasons were given for the importance of studying logic. In one of his scriptural commentaries, Samuel ibn Tibbon comments that the Gentiles, really the Christians, mocked the Jews because they lacked knowledge of science and philosophy. And some translators also viewed this later as a justification for studying logic. The importance of knowing logic for the sake of disputations with Christians is mentioned in Anatoly's introduction to his translation of Averroes' paraphrases of, the Organon, and this justification surfaces time and again in works of Hebrew logic, not just in Provence, but also in Italy and Spain. Finally, as I noted earlier, some of the earlier translations from Latin to Hebrew were of Latin medical writings. As medicine became more professionalized and regulated, Christian physicians studied logic as part of their medical school curriculum. Jewish doctors were no different. The number of Hebrew manuscripts that contains logic and medicine suggests this phenomenon was widespread. And I should also add, as a result of the first talk today, that logic was very important also in the works of anti-Christian religious polemic, not just disputational literature. So let me move on. Although, as I have said, the study of logic of Provence was generally on an elementary level through the 13th century, there appears to be an intensification of the study of logic alongside other scientific areas in the second and third decades of the 14th century. At the center of this intensive study is Levi Gersonid, who wrote a critical series of commentaries on Averroes' paraphrases of the Organon available to him, and a two of Averroes' logical questions, in addition to his own independent work on inference, the Book of the Correct Syllogism. Levi's commentaries on Averroes' paraphrases of the first seven books of the Organon are the first Hebrew super commentaries, and they provoked a strong reaction among subsequent writers. The aforementioned Judiah of Béziers, in addition to the translator savant Samuel ben Judah of Marseille and Colonimus ben Colonimus of Arles, all who appear to have been in contact with Levi, who was later called, quote, the lion among the fellowship, Leo, Levi. Judiah and Samuel ben Judah wrote objections to Gersonides' interpretations and critical glosses. Gersonides' critics seem to have been associated at one time or another with two prominent teachers of logic and philosophy in Salon de Provence, Abba Marie ben Eligdor and Moses of Beaucaire. All this occurs in the second and third decades of the 14th century. Until now, I have focused exclusively on the Arabic tradition of logic in the Jewish communities of Provence. What of scholastic logic? We will presently see that Samuel ibn Tibbon, writing in 1213, was familiar with Christian dialectica, but the earliest work of scholastic logic in Hebrew is a very interesting Hebrew adaptation of what appears to be a gloss commentary of Peter of Spain's Summae Logicalis in Provence in 1320 by Hezekiah bar Chalafta, who in his introduction says simply that he came upon Peter of Spain's book and thought that it would be a useful summary of logic for his co-religionists and helpful in disputations with the Gentiles. He supplements his work throughout with comments from the 13th century Arabic Hebrew logical tradition. Extant in one manuscript and never mentioned anywhere else, this work appears to have had no influence whatsoever as far as we know. It bears testimony to the sheer randomness of what works of Hebrew logic and philosophy and science in general survived. We must wait until the translation of Peter of Spain's Tractatus by Abraham of Vigdor at the end of the 14th century to see, based on the manuscripts, an influential work. And then it is likely that the work was more influential in northern Italy than in southern France, judging upon the distribution of the manuscripts. I should, for the sake of completeness, I have suggested elsewhere that Mordechai Natan of Arles may have been familiar with the Summulae Logicalis on the basis of his treatment of the Barbara Chalaret mnemonic in his own commentary on the Epitome of Verroes. That is written around the mid-15th century in Avignon, and it is perhaps the last work we have, a commentary of this period in Provence of the Jews. I'll move on now to the question that we also discussed in the previous talk, opposition to the study of logic in Jewish Provence. The deep impact of Maimonides' works on the Jewish communities of Provence led to two controversies that involved the rabbinic leadership, not only in Provence, but also in Christian Spain and even beyond. The first controversy in 1234 revolved around the study of Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed, his Book of Knowledge, and the permissibility of studying philosophy. The second, in 1304 to 1305, centered around the extreme allegorization of scripture, public teaching of philosophical interpretations, and again, the permissibility of studying philosophy. What was the status of logic in these controversies? Opponents of philosophy pointed to a statement in the Talmud by the 2nd to 3rd century Tana, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. The statement goes, "Restrain your sons from higayon." Now, the word higayon was interpreted by an 11th century Babylonian authority, Hai ben Shrira, as a warning against studying logic. He writes the Spanish Jewish leader, Samuel ibn Nagrila, "I adjure our prince, Lord the Prince, may he live forever, that you should not occupy yourself with the art of logic, which is a harsh vice that leads to sin, and our rabbinic sages forbade it." The interpretation was based on the identification of the Hebrew term higayon with the Arabic term mantik that we heard about, logic. And this identification was noted in Samuel ibn Tibbon's philosophical glossary of 1213 under the entry higayon. He writes, "One of the commentators interpreted restrain your sons from higayon to refer to the art of logic, which is called in Arabic mantik. And the uncircumcised call it dialectica, which is the name of one of its parts. I followed the commentator in calling it the art of logic, higayon, although calling it the art of reason is appropriate in my eyes, according to those who define man as a rational animal. In my view, it would be most appropriate to call it the art of intellect." Judah ibn Tibbon had himself translated mantik by higayon, and it may be out of filial piety that his son Samuel retained his father's translation, despite his misgivings. In any event, by interpreting higayon as logic, subsequent Jewish logicians were compelled to deal with what appeared to be an explicit Talmudic prohibition against studying logic. They adopted two main strategies in response. The first was simply to interpret the term higayon, as used by Rabbi Eliezer, as meaning something else besides logic. And that was the strategy adopted by most interpreters, including the defender of the study of philosophy, the famed Talmudist Menachem HaMeiri of Perpignan in the mid-13th century. The second strategy in diffusing the rabbinic comment was to acknowledge that Rabbi Eliezer forbade the study of logic, but to limit its scope. Thus, in the preface to his translation of Averroes' paraphrases of the Organon, Jacob Anatoly explained that Rabbi Eliezer's statements referred to refraining one's sons, but not oneself, from logic. And there were two good reasons for this. If the youth started logic too early, explains Jacob, they will be so attracted to logic and science that they would never want it to study Torah, and that, of course, would also leave them too long without religion and God. Now, later in the controversy of 1304 to 1305, the main antagonist of the philosophical camp, Abba Mari of Lunel, used the same reasoning to argue for a ban against the study of logic and philosophy under the age of 30. After all, he notes, Maimonides himself said that philosophy should only be undertaken after one has filled one's stomach with the meat and wine of Talmudic study. When a ban against the study of philosophy was finally issued by the Barcelonan rabbi Solomon ben Adret in 1305, it forbade the study of physics and metaphysics under the age of 25. Logic was not explicitly mentioned. Judiah of Béziers, in his defense of philosophy, noted that the ban did not include the preparatory sciences, by which he meant probably arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy, since he wrote these are of no harm to religion. Whether the ban was intended to include logic is not clear, but in any event, it seems to have had little to no effect on Provençal Jewry. Several years later, the Provençal philosopher and exegete Joseph Ibn Caspi counseled his young son to begin studying logic when he was 16 years old and to continue for 2 years, followed by physics for 2 years, and then metaphysics. Again, no evidence for the ban being observed. That there was no specific targeting of the study of logic by the critics of philosophy in 13th century Provence or Spain may have several reasons. First, logic was not perceived as teaching theologically problematic doctrines. As we heard from Danielle in this previous lecture, Ghazali and the Incoherence of the Philosophers have pronounced logic theologically acceptable, unlike some of the philosophical doctrines of physics and metaphysics taught by the philosophers. Second, the rabbis may have accepted the practical necessity of study of logic for the art of medicine and the practice of disputation and polemics. And third, although the rabbis of northern France at this time were not exposed to logic or philosophy, the rabbis in Spain, especially those with aristocratic background, had some familiarity with the art of logic and that would have been considered part of one's education. We noted before that Abraham Ibn Ezra in the mid-12th century Spain, not a controversial figure at this time, had commended it. This is true even for critics of philosophy, such as the Spanish rabbi Judah al-Pajar, who had criticized Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed in the 1234 dispute. For example, Maimonides had written in the Guide that were Aristotle to possess a bona fide demonstration for the eternity of the world, the beginning verses of Genesis could be interpreted to conform with that doctrine. Judah vehemently denies that Greek wisdom has the power to uproot scripture, but he goes on to say that even according to the philosophers, a demonstration cannot uproot scripture. For every complete demonstration needs great investigation, since occasionally something fallacious from the deceptive science, called in Greek sophistica, is combined with it. And this combination produces deceit to trap sages with cunning, such as concealed ambiguity or concealed false, slim, thin, and emaciated premises that yield conclusions which are not considered genuine. Alpujar was a prominent member of the Spanish Jewish aristocracy. He no doubt received some rudimentary training in Aristotelian logic. By the way, for the early modernists among us, this is the same Alpujar who was criticized by Spinoza in the Theological Political Treatise for making reason subordinate to scripture. And in the time remaining, I would like to focus on the impact of logic on traditional areas of study in the Jewish community. There were two areas in which Aristotelian logic made some inroads during these centuries. The first is the study of the Talmud, and here I must confess that the impact in the Midi is relatively minor. There is a well-known 14th century commentary on the hermeneutical rules of Rabbi Ishmael mentioned in the Talmud, composed by a Samson of Chinon, who uses language from the theory of the proposition in explanation of three rules. Now, if Samson himself ended up in Provence after the expulsion of the Jews from the Kingdom of France in 1306, along with many of his co-religionists, then he could have been exposed to logical terminology there, but that is not at all certain. More to the point, the philosopher Moses of Narbonne compares Aristotelian analogy, induction, and reductio to certain Talmudic rules of inference in his commentary on Ghazali's Opinions of the Philosophers. But Moses is known for his philosophical and not for his Talmudic expertise. We must wait until Spain in the late 14th and 15th centuries before we see widespread appropriation of Aristotelian logic in books on Talmudic hermeneutical rules. There, the case for Aristotelian impact is much more promising. A more prominent role for logic, though, is assigned to Provençal biblical exegesis. We already noted how Samuel ibn Tibbon introduced a disquisition on the syllogism in his commentary on Ecclesiastes. Jacob Anatoly goes further in his own commentary of Ecclesiastes, explaining the first few verses of the book as themselves a syllogism. So here are the first few books, verses in English. The words of Kohelet, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Kohelet is the Hebrew for Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities, says Kohelet, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage has a man from all the work he does under the sun? A generation passes away, and a generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The commentary by Jacob. King Solomon introduced the treatise by means of a proof that is a demonstrative syllogism. Vanity of vanities, says Kohelet. He means to say that all human labor concerning earthly deeds is a vanity whose causes are vain, since it is the nature of sublunar matter to be corrupt. As he goes on to explain, a generation passes away and a generation comes. Now, whatever's causes are vain is itself vanity. This is a primary intelligible and is known. So when he repeats the phrase saying vanity of vanities, the first occurrence stands for the minor premise of the syllogism, and the second stands for the major premise of the syllogism. Both yield the conclusion that there is no advantage for man in all the work he does under the sun, which is what was sought, the quaesitum. Now the sages consider this proof to be demonstrative, which is why Solomon cited it first. Afterwards, he said everything is vanity to make known the proof by induction. For by canvassing every particular human deed one by one and showing that laboring over it is in vain, it is apparent to all that everything is vanity. So by means of both kinds of proof, we know that there is no advantage for man in all the work he does under the sun. Now, that should be under the sun, S-U-N, I'm sorry. His saying between the propositions, said Ecclesiastes, indicates that the conclusion proceeds through that which proceeds from two premises being gathered together, because the Hebrew word Kohelet means the gatherer. So the word Ecclesiastes actually tells us we are to combine these two propositions into a premise, for that is how it is called in Greek. The most extreme example, if you didn't think that was extreme, the most extreme example of applying Aristotelian to logic to biblical exegesis is provided by the 14th century intellectual Joseph Ibn Caspi of Argentière, who wholeheartedly embraces logic and grammar as a means of decoding the secrets of Scripture. Caspi actually wrote for his son Solomon his own compendium of logic, quote, "For the knowledge of Scripture is every man's goal, and the cognoscenti know that it is impossible to understand Scripture without knowing the art of logic." Caspi does not merely appeal to logical doctrines to explain Scripture. He also claims that Scripture itself alludes to logical doctrines. For example, he accuses the multitude of considering the biblical terms for wonder and marvel to imply supernatural occurrences. Marvel or mofet could be translated as miracle as well. But he says, a mofet simply means a demonstration of which there are two types, a demonstration of the fact and a demonstration of the reason why. Now, since false prophets are said to be given signs and marvels, it is clear, says Caspi, that there can be nothing supernatural about their demonstrations, a claim which fits well with Caspi's pronounced naturalism. Elsewhere, he claims that the biblical term sign, ot, and marvel, mofet, capture the distinction between factual and explanatory demonstrations, which Dalil and Burhan, but that's okay. Oh. Caspi's philosophically bold reading of the scripture aroused the ire of the philosophical sages of Salon de Provence, who deputized the philosophical translator Colonimus ben Colonimus of Arles to respond. Colonimus says contra Caspi that the distinction between ot and mofet has nothing to do with the Aristotelian distinction between types of demonstrations. quia and propter quid. The first term signifies something whose existence is a weak sign. The second signifies a very strong sign. Now, the sages of Salon had criticized Caspi for anachronistically rejecting the technical senses of the Arabic Burhan into the Hebrew of the Bible. In other words, that he was reading the Bible in light of the Tibbonide translators from Burhan to Mofet. Now, Colonimus rejects this criticism, since the translators may have chosen the term Mofet to render Burhan because they thought it captured the biblical sense of the term. But he continues, after an exhaustive study of every occurrence of Mofet in the Bible, Colonimus concludes it has nothing to do with the Aristotelian sense of demonstration and is used in cases where Aristotelian demonstrations would be inappropriate. He adds that even if one were to weaken Aristotelian demonstration to requiring a single condition, as does Caspi, that will not work, because according to Ibn Bajjah and Ibn Rushd, he continues, the minimum numbers of conditions for the premises of an absolute demonstration are three. So this is a philosophical response to a philosophical excessive interpretation, according to Colonimus. But it is a philosophical response in the service of a more traditional reading. To sum up, from the 13th to the 15th centuries, there was a flowering of scientific and philosophical study in the Jewish communities of the Midi, or what I've called Jewish Provence. Maimonides' exhortation to study logic seems to have had a significant impact in the intellectual life of the sages there. Not only was logic itself studied, but traces of logic could be found in the traditional fields of Jewish studies, such as biblical exegesis and, to a smaller extent, the study of Talmud. On the whole, logic was studied at an elementary level, with manuals and compendia prevailing, either translated by or composed by Jews, with the exception of what I've called this short golden age of study surrounding the works of Gersonides, which is at a rather high level. The motives for its studies were varied, ranging from the desire to show the Gentiles that the Jews were not ignorant of wisdom, to the needs of participants in interreligious disputation and polemic, to the training of physicians, and finally, simply for the sake of acquiring the knowledge necessary for human happiness. Attempts to prohibit the study of logic on the basis of an interpretation of a Talmudic prohibition never really bore fruit, first because the study of logic was simply not an issue in the controversy surrounding the study of philosophy in Provence, and second because that interpretation was not the predominant one. And finally, the texts studied were mainly those of the Hebrew translations of the Arabic Aristotelians, Farabi, Averroes, and Avicenna, via Ghazali's intentions of the, or opinions of the philosophers. Beginning in the 14th century, there was an encounter with scholastic logic, specifically the Summulae Logicalis of Peter of Spain, which proved useful for the training of physicians and those engaged in disputations. The claim that scholastic logic was superior to the logic of the Arabs, the claim we hear, would come later among the Jewish intellectuals of 15th century Spain and Italy. Merci. Thank you.